Welcome to Section 9. My name is Damien Hull, and I'm here with Dorothy.
Hello.
And it's 2017.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So in this new year, we're trying to reorganize a little bit, trying to figure out how to do the podcast a little better, trying to figure out how to do our IT projects a little better and learn IT a little bit better to make things a little easier for us. But for this episode, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a firewall story that I have. We're going to talk about an IP address issue that we have with our existing firewall project. And then we're going to talk about some of the security software that we're going to be using this year. So the firewall story here. Years ago, I was getting into IT, and this was back in like 1998, 99. And I was just learning IT and learning about all the different things that you have to do in IT with Windows and networking and IP addresses. And one of the things I learned about was a firewall. And at the time, I didn't really know what that was or how to use one because I've never seen one. And also about this time, I had dial-up internet service. And I decided I was going to go and get cable modem service, a faster internet connection, no longer using that phone line to get online that was slow. You got to, you know, use the modem and everything else. So I decided, okay, before I get the cable modem in here and an always-on internet connection, I want to have a firewall. And I had recently learned how to install Red Hat Linux because I had purchased a book at the bookstore that had some instructions on how to actually use that.
Why did you think you needed a firewall if you didn't know what it was or, you know?
Well, you know, when I went to class for that, they just briefly talked about it and how it would actually protect you from people on the internet that might want to access some of your resources.
So you kind of knew what it did, but you weren't really sure?
Never seen one.
Okay.
So there's a big difference between saying, okay, yeah, I've heard of what a firewall is. It's like, okay, I've heard of what other things are, but you've never seen one. You've never worked with it before.
Yeah.
So it's like Linux. You know, Linux was a new thing for me back then. I'd never even heard of it. I just found the book and decided, okay, let's go try this and see how this thing works. So with the firewall thing, I'm like, okay, I want one. And I had just recently figured out that there was a way to do firewalls with Linux because I had found a book at the bookstore, just like with the Red Hat book, I found one on firewalls and it was open source firewalls. So it actually covered a couple of things. Linux was part of it. And it also had something about OpenBSD, which I'd never heard of before. So I went ahead and followed the instructions in the book. And I bought myself a computer or got one from somewhere. It was a 486. And I figured out I had to have a couple of network cards in there. So I did that. And then I found out how to install Linux on there and follow the instructions in the book to set up the actual firewall itself. And this was back in the days when we had IP chains. So if you're using a Linux firewall today, you're going to use IP tables, which is a little bit different. And I don't really know what the differences are because back then, I really didn't understand what it was I was doing. I was just following along in the book and, you know, doing whatever the book said. And eventually, I was actually able to get it to work. But in order to do that, as I said before, I had to get a computer, I had to get network cards, I had to figure out the IP addresses. I might have done something with the DHCP server because I wanted the LAN side of my network to have automatically assigned IP addresses for things like my workstation. And then I had to have an IP address for the outside interface or the WAN side of the network connection or a firewall. And so that came from the ISP side. And that was just DHCP assigned at the time. So that was my introductory to firewalls. That's how I did it. I just jumped in and followed the instructions in the book. And after I did that, at some point, I went ahead and did the OpenBSD firewall following the instructions, which was a little bit interesting because I'd never used OpenBSD before, never even installed it.
What is OpenBSD?
So OpenBSD is another operating system. So it's like Linux is an operating system, Windows is an operating system. OpenBSD is just another operating system. And it kind of falls into that category of open source operating systems. It's a little different than Linux. It's Unix-like, so some of the commands are the same. So once I got it installed, I could actually use my Linux knowledge to move around in the operating system and get certain things done. But the installation process was a little tricky because it's command line only. There's no kind of graphical interface of any kind in there.
Was there like, I know you were telling me that in the past when you did Linux, it wasn't as easy as it is today to install things or to, you know, did Linux have a GUI back then?
So when you did the installation for Linux, there was no actual GUI. Like you couldn't use your mouse. but it had what they call the NCurses interface type of thing. So what that did was it kind of presented you with options, right? You had something that looked like a graphical interface, and you could use your arrow keys and tab around and select different things, and you could figure out how to make it work. With OpenBSD, all it did was give you a command prompt, and then you had to type in a command to get the thing set up so that it would do the installation. So there were instructions in there for that, and I had to follow that and figure out how to make it work. And then once I got it installed, everything was fine. And then I just followed the instructions in the book to set up the firewall rules and make all that happen. So there's a lot of things that I learned by doing that. And this is one of the things that we're trying to get into now is, okay, we have our book knowledge, we have our videos that we watch, we have people that we talk to learn more about IT, but how do we actually take that to the next level and actually apply that to a real-world scenario where we're working with the devices? So my advice to you is to just go out and do it. Find instructions and just jump in and do it. Because again, when I did this, I didn't know a lot about hardware. I didn't know a lot about the software side, nothing about firewall rules or how they worked. So I learned about hardware. I learned about software. I learned about firewall rules. I learned about things like NAT. I learned about
how hard was it for you to kind of try to figure it all out? Because as you've seen last week when we were trying to do the firewall project, you know, had you not been there to, you know, guide me and tell me, oh yeah, this is what it is, I would have been really confused. So how does, you know, a beginner, how does someone that doesn't know, how things apply?
This is the same thing that I was telling you before when we were doing the firewall project. Right. There's a lot of things you're not going to understand, but mm-hmm. if you just jump in and do them with some of the knowledge that you already have, as you go through the process of doing that, you're going to learn a lot along the way. And that's how you actually learn how to do these kinds of things. So again, I was going to school for some of this stuff, learning about networks and IP addresses and how these things go together. So some of it I was able to figure out because I was already in class learning about things like IP addresses, learning about devices like a switch. Even though I really didn't understand what a switch did at the time, I knew I needed one to plug all my computers together. And then I know I needed an IP address for the network side, you know, a network address and an IP address for the interfaces on the firewall. So there were some basic things I understood, but a lot of it I didn't understand exactly how this thing was supposed to work. So as I'm putting this together, one of the things that I was doing at the time is I would play a game called Counter-Strike, and I had that installed on my workstation. And the way it works is kind of the client-server model that we always talk about. So the client software is Counter-Strike installed on my workstation, and then it talks to the server out on the internet. So when I would play the game going through my Linux firewall using IP chains, it didn't work. And I couldn't figure out for a while why it wasn't working. And then I remembered, oh, there's ports I have to think about. Well, I didn't know what port numbers were available or were supposed to be open for my game to work properly. Because what happens is packets leave my workstation, go through the firewall, out to the Counter-Strike server, and then the Counter-Strike server wants to send stuff back. Well, it can't because the ports that are supposed to be open for that are closed and it can't access or the information gets blocked or dropped by the firewall because they're not allowed in.
So the ports that you were sending your information out were in the same ports that the information was coming back in?
There may be different ones in there, but it wanted to send data back to my my workstation, my client, you know, the Counter-Strike client on my workstation, and the firewall was not allowing that to happen because it was blocking all that information.
So what did you end up doing?
So in my case, I thought, well, I could look up the ports, but I got lazy and I said, okay, well, if the firewall's blocking those ports, let's just turn off the firewall rules. So I will still have NATPAT functioning on the firewall so that I can have internet access, but all the firewall rules that block traffic from coming in on the outside, those would be turned off. And I thought, well, I'm only going to be playing for an hour or two, so if I turn them off and then turn them back on again, that shouldn't be too bad. And then I don't have ports open all the time on the firewall for my game. So I would turn off the firewall rules, play the game, turn them back on, and everything worked out just fine.
So it wasn't one of those firewalls that remembered the ports? Or?
So this is what I did. I at some point decided I wanted to try out the OpenBSD firewall.
Okay.
So using that same 486 computer that I had, I went ahead and installed OpenBSD on there, got it all configured, and was able to get everything to function properly so that I had internet access. Nice. And so that was my OpenBSD firewall. And I thought, okay, well, this is cool and all, but you know, what's the difference between a Linux firewall and an OpenBSD firewall? So one day, I'm playing my Counter-Strike game, and in the middle of the game, I realize, hey, I didn't turn off the firewall rules. So I went and sat down a bit, and I thought about, okay, what's really going on here? And then it hit me. OpenBSD has a stateful packet filtering firewall system. And it was called packet filter. I don't know if that's still the same thing that they have now, because I haven't done a lot with the OpenBSD firewalls recently. So, but back then they called it packet filter, and that was stateful. And what that means is, as my packets leave my workstation and go through the OpenBSD firewall, the PF or packet filter, it would tag the packet before it sent it out. So let's say, for example, the tag is 12345. So it sends that packet to the Counter-Strike server. The Counter-Strike server gets that, does whatever it needs to do, and then when it wants to send data back to my Counter-Strike software on my workstation, the client side, it tags the packet 12345. When it reaches my firewall, the firewall sees a tag on there, 12345, and says, hey, this tag matches this, what do we call that, this connection that was originated from inside the network on the LAN side of the firewall. Let's let this back in. So there's kind of like a little database or something in there that you have where it's tracking all this information. So all of the connections that are going in and out of the firewall, this packet filter system is keeping state or tracking all of the connections. So I thought, this is awesome. I don't have to open up ports on the firewall. I just play my game and everything's fine.
So you don't have to go and try to figure out those ports. So that is the difference between a stateful and a stateless
Right, because firewall? At the time, Linux didn't have a stateful packet filtering firewall. Okay. So when I put in the OpenBSD PF packet filtering firewall system that they had in there, that was stateful. So that tracked all of those connections. So for me, that was like huge. I was like, oh, this is awesome, because now it's automatic. I don't have to worry about what ports need to be opened up. This is great. And then eventually I went and did some more fancier things. I actually added another network card in there. And that's when I learned about three-legged firewalls. And basically what that means is that every network card that you have in there is sometimes referred to as a leg. Although I've never really heard anybody talk about that other than in the book where they talk about the different legs of the firewall. Mm-hmm. So if you have two network cards, that would be two legs. If you have three network cards, that would be three legs, because each network card's a leg.
Wow.
And I used a third network interface card as a DMZ, and at one point I used to have my own FreeBSD email server. And FreeBSD is just another operating system. It's kind of Unix-like. So again, the Linux and BSD knowledge I had could be used on FreeBSD to be able to type in certain commands and move around things like CD and LS, all of that works the same. And I was able to set up a FreeBSD email server using port 25 and then port 110 for POP. And then I would have an email client on my workstation to check my email. And so by doing all of that, I was able to learn about firewalls and ports and connections and stateful and stateless packet filtering firewalls. So there's a lot of things that you're going to learn by jumping in and doing these things, even if you're not entirely sure how to do them. Because when I did this, it took me a long time to get all this stuff to work properly. So it's not like I did it in a couple of days. It took me, you know, maybe a week to get my firewall working properly. It took me, you know, a week to figure out how to get my email server up and running. And then again, like I said, just installing things like OpenBSD, that took a while because it was all command line only. So you had to figure out how to do even that piece. And when we were doing our pfSense firewall, our firewall project, which we talked about in our previous episode, we ran into issues that you don't think about unless you're actually doing them. So we had an issue with IP addressing. So you were using the /16.
Right. No, usually, I thought I had the subnetting part down. And that was the hard part for me because, you know, I could subnet a network. You know, you give me an IP address, tell me how many hosts, and I'm there. And I thought I'd get pretty fancy this time during that firewall project and decided to use slash 16. And oh my gosh.
So the first thing that we wanted to do in our firewall project is say, okay, what is the IP address going to be on the LAN side of the firewall?
Right.
So that's going to be the default gateway for all of the hosts on the LAN side of the firewall. So the IP address that you picked was 10.10.1.0/16.
Right.
So this is where subnetting comes into play. And if you are not familiar with subnetting, it takes a while to get it. It took me a couple of years to actually figure this out because I had the same issue that you're having where you do a subnet for a slash 24, a slash 25, a slash 28, right. And everything kind of makes sense in some way. You move into slash 16, and then it's like, well, how do I work with this? Right. So the issue that we ran into with 10.10.1.0/16 is that when we do our DHCP server, the DHCP server wants a pool of addresses it's going to hand out.
Right.
So the big issue here is the starting address and the ending address. So mm-hmm. if we look at your slash 16 subnet here, the network address is going to be 10.10.0/16.
Right.
And then the broadcast or last address that we have in here is going to be 10.10.255.255/16.
Right.
So your IP address that you selected for the LAN interface is kind of in the middle. So right. if I want to have a pool of addresses that starts at 10.10.0.50 and then goes all the way to 10.10.255.254, which is the last usable IP address on that network, mm-hmm. your 10.10.1.0 address is kind of in the middle of all of that.
Right. And I didn't understand that, which it was interesting because when you were telling me about when you did your network at work and you were saying, gosh, you know, the way that this is set up, we have the pool of addresses in the middle on this one, at the end of that one. It didn't dawn on me. And I did exactly what, you know, whoever set up the network before you came along had done on that. And, you know, and I like to take pride in myself to say, okay, you know, my default gateway is always going to be the, you know, .1, right? You know, the first address on the network and what have you. But I didn't really understand, you know, when you're putting a network together that you really don't want to do that. You want to just have those addresses in a place where it's at the beginning, you know, is manageable and it's not all over the place. You know, and this network is at the beginning and this one is in the middle because that will make a mess. And, you know, that was really an eye-opener for me.
And it's hard to see that unless you actually do it.
Right.
Because you can read about this kind of stuff. But until you actually use it, it's kind of hard to figure out, hey, do I really understand this? Do I know what's going on? And then there are going to be things like this that come up where you didn't even know this problem existed until you actually go do it. Mm-hmm. And as you're building your firewall, as you're being asked all these questions, and you need to do a DHCP server on the firewall, and then it asks you about all this other stuff, then you realize, oh, hey, I don't really understand this subnetting thing like I thought I did.
Well, and not only that, for me, my inexperience is that, you know, I remember you telling me about this thing at work and how everything was all over the place. And I thought, you know, here I was trying to, you know, thinking I understood how to put the network together, thinking that I was going to do that. And it was that part, like I said, that inexperience that I didn't do this before. And I didn't realize that putting those addresses, you know, right smack in the middle part of it, you know, how it would affect the network and eventually would have been really confusing on an enterprise environment. So...
Right, right. Because what you don't want to have in a network is IP addresses that are kind of all over the place where mm-hmm. when you do your DHCP server, you want your pool of addresses to be one seamless pool of addresses.
Right.
You don't want to be in a situation where you're reserving a portion of addresses because basically what happens when you do DHCP is there's a starting address and ending address of IP addresses it's going to hand out.
Right.
And so the way I like to do it is to simplify things by saying, okay, the beginning portion of the IP space is going to be some sort of a reserved space.
Right.
So for example, if we have, let's say our 10.10.0.0/16 network, I would say, okay, 10.10.0.1 to 10.10.0.50 or maybe 100 would be reserved. Mm-hmm. So if I use 100 as a reserve, then I can say, okay, we're going to start from 101.
Right.
So that's the starting address of our pool. the ending address is going to be 10.10.255.254.
Right.
So we're clearly defining what is reserved space for potential servers or any host on the network that needs a static address. Maybe a printer needs a static address, something like that. So we're clearly defining what is a reserved address for statically assigned hosts and what is going to be DHCP assigned within that DHCP pool.
See, and that part is like when you have four or five servers, if you get into the habit of always doing the reserve on the same, you know, block, then you're not going to go, oh, the reserve on this server is from 100 to what have you. The reserve on this one is going to be from 1 to 100. So, you know, and that just, it would make it really confusing. So I've learned a lot from that, I'm telling you.
Yeah, yeah. So if you just jump in and start doing things, whether that's with a firewall project like the one that we're working on, or if you get some sort of router from Best Buy and you want to play around with that, or even if you're just going to install things like Windows 10, you can get a trial copy and practice that.
But you know, it's scary to jump in because you don't want to screw up no matter what. I mean, and you know how I feel about this. It's like, you know, like when I first started learning about IT, a server was such a mystery, you know, and then you came in one day, it's like server's a computer. A computer that gives services out. You have a client and you have a server, and this is what they do, and the server provides a service. And it was like, wait, why didn't somebody just tell me that before?
Right,
you know, because
right.
You're sitting there making it this big mystery. You have to treat a server, and you know, it's scary when you're looking at a device and you're going, how do I plug this in? How do I put it together? And how do I make this talk to that? So, you know. But I do see the value of that because, you know, if you just stick to the videos and the books and you don't put it into practice, I think there's a lot of value in the practice of it, of jumping in with both feet, whether you screw it up or not, and then, you know, start over and try to get it figured out, you know.
Right, right, right. So now one thing that I think is going to help us with our projects and doing that is we have our Cisco network lifecycle,
mm-hmm.
but then the other thing I'm going to be looking at too is this thing called Agile. And we've talked briefly about that. You're not too familiar with that. I'm actually not too familiar with that. But one of the things that I've seen a lot of in sort of the security side of things and the IT management side of things is this whole thing about how do we manage large enterprise projects? How do we manage a situation where we have lots of things going on? So Agile is a project management tool that sort of simplifies how we do things. And I'm going to give you the simplified version because I don't really understand how this thing works. But basically what you do here is you say, okay, we have, let's say, our firewall project, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what you're going to do is you're going to break that down into small, we call them goals. And so you might have a goal that would say, the goal here for today is going to be figuring out what hardware requirements we have. Another goal might be to figure out how to install pfSense.
Right.
Another goal might be to figure out how to connect that firewall to the network.
Mm-hmm.
So within each goal, you're going to have a list of tasks that you have to complete in order for you to achieve that goal. So for example, if you want to know how to install pfSense, you need to go online and read the documentation. So one task might be to figure out how to download pfSense. Another task might be figuring out how to install pfSense by reading the instructions.
Well, another thing is you need to know what are the minimum requirements to install pfSense and then take a look at your device and go, okay, do I have this?
Right. You know, so there's a lot of steps that are going to be required in order for you to achieve a goal. Right. And the big difference between traditional project management and Agile is that your goal is going to be what they call a sprint, a short little sprint. So you're not having a goal that says, okay, we're gonna install a pfSense firewall. That goal is too big,
right?
Because you're going to have a lot of steps involved in reaching that goal. So what we're saying is, okay, break it down into smaller steps. Have a goal that says, okay, we're going to look at the hardware requirements of pfSense.
Mm-hmm.
That's a goal. So you're shortening that little project timeline into smaller chunks. So if something goes wrong in a small chunk or what they call a sprint, you might be able to fix that a lot easier than you would if you were looking at an overall project where you have everything sort of mapped out, Everything has a timeline. Everything has a deadline. And to change something means you have to go further down the line and make modifications down there as well.
Well, and it may take you longer to try to figure out too what it is that is wrong, you know.
Yeah. So this is supposed to be an easier way to manage a project. And we're not going to be sticklers on this. We're not gonna follow it completely because we're learning and we don't really understand how this is supposed to be applied. So we're going to take bits and pieces of Agile and we're going to work that into our network lifecycle, our Cisco network lifecycle,
you know,
to make help.
I like the lifecycle. You know, I do like the prepare stage and the plan stage and how they all interact. I do think Agile is helpful to when you're looking at the prepare stage and breaking it down into bite-sized pieces to where you're not so overwhelmed and go, oh, you know, because I know that you can do this at a larger scale. I can't. I have to have those little bite-sized pieces to sit in there and go, you know, one of the best things that we did last week that I really enjoyed, because I'm always fearful of if I have to buy a device for the network, how am I going to know? What if I make a mistake? It's somebody else's money, blah, 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 right? And what was really good to me, for me was, you know, I got to figure out what the minimum requirements for pfSense was. And then they had the recommended, you know, which was good, the minimum and recommended part of it. And then when I went into the other part to see what our firewall had, you know, when I look at the specifications, you know, then I would look at the minimum and I would look at the recommended and I would go, oh, I got that. And I got a little bit more than that. Okay, so this is cool. And check that off. Oh, you know, my CPU. Yeah, I got that. I got that. You know, so it puts my mind at ease a little bit better in the respect that if I ever get asked, okay, you need to buy a server, a computer, or maybe, you know, a firewall that has to have the specifications and this is what you're going to install in it, I think I could probably put something together to where it wouldn't be like, what the heck am I going to do? You know, so I like that and I appreciate it.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of having things like your network lifecycle and Agile is to help you break things down into smaller pieces so that you can take it on. Because if you look at it as a whole, especially when you're trying to do an entirely new network or something like that for a large office or an enterprise environment,
right. That's
too hard to try to think of it all at once. You think of it as smaller pieces.
Yeah.
And then we also have our security software that we're going to be using in the future here. And this is something that we're going to be doing every so often is reviewing what it is we need to do to make sure that Section 9 is safe. Right. So one of the things you've been using, and I recommended it, although I don't actually use it myself, which I should be doing,
right,
is Secunia PSI. So you want to talk about that?
Well, I like Secunia because what it does is the software that you download on your computer and basically checks, you know, the software. You know, it looks at, you know, if you have Wireshark or Adobe or Google, Chrome and everything. And what it does, it just runs a scan to make sure that everything is safe and secure. It tells you sometimes there is a, you know, it will update it, but it will update it in a way that if there is anything goofy that is going to be, you know, not kosher for your computer, or that it may be something that you don't need or that is not you know, what you can have in there that it may be dangerous or, you know, just a virus or something, it will check on that and it won't let it happen. Also, what it does is there are certain applications that you're going to have that there's going to require for you to do it manually. So you actually have some control on that.
Right. So the main focus of Secunia PSI is to make sure that you're doing your patch management for your personal computer. So for example, if I install it on my laptop, I run it, it's going to tell me, oh, you have these four or five applications that need to be updated. So I don't have to go around and check all four or five. I just run Secunia and it tells me that they need to be updated.
But it goes further than that, because when you look at it and it tells you, it does what that Lookout Security does for the phone, for example. You know, it will look at an application, and if there is something that you're not supposed to be getting because it doesn't look right, it's not going to do it. So it will tell you, your computer is 98% secure, you know, based on your applications, and it will tell you this needs to be updated. And yeah, you can update them all at the same time, but I think it does much more than patch your computer in the respect that have those done.
And I don't know that because I haven't actually used it yet.
Yeah, because that was the part that was appealing to me when you went to the SANS training and you say, hey, try this. At first I thought, well, it's just updating that. But no, it isn't, because you scan it and then it tells you, you know, what percentage of your PC based on your applications. It, you know, and maybe I've maybe, you know, reading it wrong, but that's what it, you know, when you look at.
Yeah, we'll review that and we'll talk about that in a future episode where we talk about some of the security software that we're actually using to make sure our systems are secure. And I should point out that this is for Windows only. You can't use it on a Mac and doesn't work on Linux.
Right, right.
So it is Windows only. The other one, and this is something I found out when I was listening to, not Paul's, there's, so we've been listening to Paul's Security Weekly, but he's also got other podcasts that kind of fall underneath his Paul's Security Weekly. So there's one that's Naked Something, Naked Security or something like that. It's really short, talks about some applications that you can use or software that you can use to keep yourself secure. And the one that we're talking about that I thought it's really cool and we need to test it is Ransom Free. So Ransom Free takes care of ransomware, and it's supposed to be able to catch the ransomware before it encrypts your stuff. So the way that ransomware works is you accidentally download it by clicking on something, and then it gets installed on your system, and it encrypts all of your data.
And then you can't get to it.
And then you can't get to it, and then there's going to be some sort of pop-up that tells you, okay, you need to go to this website, and you need to pay us X amount of money to get the key to unlock your data.
Right.
So Ransom Free is supposed to catch that ransomware before all that happens. So we're going to try that out.
Does something it sandbox that you can, it or do you know?
I don't know exactly how it works. But yes, sometimes what will happen is things like antivirus software, some of the security software will stick that virus in kind of like a sandbox or quarantine it so that you can take a look at it later on and decide if you want to delete that.
Yeah. And you know, you should check his podcast. It's really, I mean, he's got a great information, a lot of great information, and it's worthwhile listening to it.
Yeah. And the other thing we want to take a look at, and this is something, these are things I'd like you to take a look at because it's something I think is important for you to learn more about and keep things up to date. And this also goes along with maintaining our existing systems and making sure they all work properly. So the other one, and we had this issue the other day, Windows Update.
Yeah.
We need to figure out how to turn that thing off because we want to be able to specify when we do our Windows Update rather than having Windows say, okay, there's updates, let's update now. Because the annoying thing that happens, and this happens to everybody, Microsoft decides when you're going to get your updates.
Right.
And so when Windows, whether it's Windows 10, Windows 7, it will automatically go online, check for updates, and right in the middle of working on something, it will say, okay, we're updating, got to restart, and you don't have an option of stopping that.
Right, and I don't think that you have that option on Windows 10. I know you did have it on 8 and 7. I don't know, but we'll check on that.
Yeah, we'll have to check on that, because I thought I heard something or read something somewhere where Windows 10 Home Edition doesn't have it, but Windows 10 Professional might have some sort of option in there.
I have a feeling.
But it's not something that you can, it's not like a button you click on. You have to edit the registry or something like that.
No, you might have to, because I was listening to Windows Weekly with Mary Jo Foley and what was his name again?
Oh, Paul, yeah.
Yeah, Paul Thoreau. And that was one of the things that a lot of people were complaining prior to the release of Windows 10. And they were saying, no, you know, Windows has decided that, you know, they're going to be doing the updates themselves. They don't want people to, you know. And one of the big things is that people were like, okay, so what are they updating? They're not telling us what they're updating. And it was a big issue. So we'll check into it and then, you know, report back to you. But, you know, it was one of the things that I don't think that Windows 10 will allow you to do that unless you want to mess with the registry. And very few people want to do that. At least I'm not confident in
that. Yeah, but we can test that. That's why we have our virtual machines. Yeah. You can go in there.
I mean, we can do it in the virtual machine if you wanted to do that on the Windows 10.
And yeah, then we just test it and see what happens.
You know, if we break it, then we can just like
make a new one.
Make a new one. So,
yeah.
The beauty of the labs.
Yeah. So again, if you're interested in learning some of the stuff that we're doing or you want to get more into IT and learn more about how it works, you just have to jump in and do it. You just find some little thing that you think is going to be interesting for you, something you want to learn. And you just go do it. And then we're also trying to figure out how to keep all of the stuff that we currently have operational, staying operational by making sure we have the right security software in there, doing our updates. And in the future, we're going to talk more about how we maintain our security here at Section 9 and also maintain all of our servers that we have in the cloud and all of that. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. So we are looking forward to this new year, share with you what we do and, you know, learn lots along the way. So Happy New Year. And do you have anything to add?
No, that's it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.